Townsend and Andy Mason arrived at the state police barracks in Scarborough at 8:30 a.m. Mason let Townsend run with the ball. This was his bailiwick, not Mason's, and there was not a thing wrong with Andy's ears. The duty officer told them that Stephen Kemp was on his way back to Maine. There had been no problem about that, but Kemp still wasn't talking. His van had been given a thorough going over by Massachusetts lab technicians and forensics experts. Nothing had turned up, which might indicate a woman and a boy had been held in the back. But they had found a nice little pharmacy in the van's wheel well. Marijuana, some cocaine in an Anison bottle, 3 amyl nitrate poppers, and 2 speedy combinations of the type known as Black Beauties. It gave them a handy hook to hang Mr. Kemp on for the time being. "That Pinto," Andy said to Townsend, bringing them each a cup of coffee. "Where's that fucking Pinto of hers?" Townsend shook his head. "Has Bannerman called anything in?" "Nope." "Well, give him a shout. Tell him I want him down here when they bring Kemp in. It's his jurisdiction, and I guess he's got to be the questioning officer. Technically, at least." Townsend came back 5 minutes later looking puzzled. "I can't get him, Mr. Mason. Their dispatcher's tried him and says he must not be in his car." "Christ, he's probably having coffee down at the cozy corner." "Well, fuck him, he's out of it." Andy Mason lit a fresh pell-mell, coughed, and then grinned at Townsend. "Think we can handle this Kemp without him?" Townsend smiled back. "Oh, I think we can manage." Mason nodded. "This thing is starting to look bad, Mr. Townsend. Very bad." "It's not good. I'm beginning to wonder if this Kemp didn't bury them in the ditch beside some farm road between Castle Rock and Twickenham." Mason smiled again. "But we'll crack him, Mr. Townsend. I've cracked tough nuts before this." "Yes, sir," Townsend said respectfully. He believed Mason had. "We'll crack him if we have to sit in this office and sweat him for 2 days. Townsend slipped out every 15 minutes or so, trying to make contact with George Bannerman. He knew Bannerman only slightly, but he held a higher opinion of him than Mason did, and he thought Bannerman deserved to be warned that Andy Mason was on the prod for him. When he still hadn't reached Bannerman by 10 o'clock, he began to feel worried. He also began to wonder if he should mention Bannerman's continued silence to Mason, or if he should hold his peace. Roger Breakstone arrived in New York at 8:49 a.m. on the Eastern Shuttle, cabbed into the city, and checked into the Biltmore a little before 9:30. "The reservation was for 2? The desk clerk asked.
"My partner has been called home on an emergency."
"What a pity," the desk clerk said indifferently, and gave Roger a card to fill out. While he did so, the desk clerk talked to the cashier about the Yankee tickets he had gotten for the following weekend. Roger lay down in his room trying to nap, but in spite of his poor rest the night before, no sleep would come.
"Donna screwing some other man. Vic holding on to all of that, trying to anyway, in addition to this stinking mess over a red sugary kitty cereal. Now Donna and Tad had disappeared. Vic had disappeared. Everything had somehow gone up in smoke this last week. Neatest trick you ever saw. Presto changeo. Everything's a big pile of shit."
His head ached. The ache came in big, greasy, thumping waves. At last he got up, not wanting to be alone with his bad head and his bad thoughts any longer. He thought he might as well go on over to Summer's Marketing and Research at 47th and Park and spread some gloom around there. After all, what else did AdWorks pay them for? He stopped in the lobby for aspirin and walked over. The walk did nothing for his head, but it did give him a chance to renew his hate-hate relationship with New York.
"Not back here," he thought. "I'll go to work throwing cartons of Pepsi on a truck before I bring Althea and the girls back here." Summers was on the 14th floor of a big, stupid-looking, energy-efficient skyscraper. The receptionist smiled and nodded when Roger identified himself. "Mr. Hewitt has just stepped out for a few minutes. Is Mr. Trenton with you?"
"No, he was called home."
"Well, I have something for you. It just came in this morning." She handed Roger a telegram in a yellow envelope. It was addressed to V. Trenton, R. Breakstone, AdWorks, care of Image Eye Studios. Rob had forwarded it to Summers Marketing late yesterday. Roger tore it open and saw at once that it was from Old Man Sharp, and that it was fairly long.
"Walking papers, here we come," he thought, and read the telegram.
The telephone woke Vic up at a few minutes before 12, otherwise he might have slept most of the afternoon away as well. His sleep had been heavy and soggy, and he woke with a terrible feeling of disorientation. The dream had come again, Donna and Tad in a rocky niche, barely beyond the reach of some terrible mythical beast. The room actually seemed to whirl around him as he reached for the telephone. "Donna and Tad," he thought, "they're safe."
"Hello?"
"Vic, it's Roger."
"Roger?"
He sat up. His shirt was plastered to his body. Half his mind was still asleep and grappling with that dream. The light was too strong. The heat, it had been relatively cool when he went to sleep. Now the bedroom was an oven. How late was it? How late had they let him sleep? The house was so silent.
"Roger, what time is it?"
"Time?" Roger paused. "Why, just 12 o'clock.
"What, 12? Oh, Christ. Roger, I've been asleep.
What's happened, Vic? Are they back?"
"They weren't when I went to sleep. That bastard Mason promised."
"Who's Mason?"
"He's in charge of the investigation. Roger, I have to go. I have to find out..."
"Hold on, man. I'm calling from Summers. I've got to tell you. There was a telegram from Sharp in Cleveland. We're keeping the account."
"What? What?"
It was all going too fast for him. Donna, the account, Roger sounding almost absurdly cheerful.
"There was a telegram here when I came in. The old man and his kid sent it to Image Eye, and Rob forwarded it here. You want me to read it?"
"Give me the gist."
"Old Man Sharp and the kid apparently came to the same conclusion, using different chains of logic. The old man sees the Zingers thing as a replay of the Alamo. We're the good guys standing on the battlements, standing by to repel the boarders. All got to stick together, all for one and one for all."
"Yeah, I knew he had that in him," Vic said, rubbing the back of his neck. "He's a loyal old bastard. That's why he came with us when we left New York."
"The kid would still like to get rid of us, but he doesn't think this is the right time. He thinks it would be interpreted as a sign of weakness and even possible culpability. Can you believe it?"
"I could believe anything coming from that paranoid little twerp.
They want us to fly to Cleveland and sign a new 2-year contract. It's not a 5-year deal, and when it's up, the kid's almost sure to be in charge and will undoubtedly be invited to take a long walk off a short dock. But 2 years, it's enough time, Vic. In 2 years, we'll be on top of it. We can tell them..."
"Roger, I've got to..."
"To take their lousy pound cake and pound it up their asses. They also want to discuss the new campaign, and I think they'll go for the serial professor's swan song, too."
"That's great, Roger, but I've got to find out what the Christ has been happening with Donna and Tad."
Yeah, I guess it was a lousy time to call, but I couldn't keep it to myself, man. I would have busted like a balloon."
"There's no bad time for good news," Vic said.
All the same, he felt a stab of jealousy, as painful as a sliver of sharpened bone, at the happy relief in Roger's voice, and a bitter disappointment that he couldn't share in Roger's feelings. But maybe it was a good omen.
"Vic, call me when you hear, okay?"
"I will, Rog. Thanks for the call."
He hung up, slipped into his loafers, and went downstairs.
The kitchen was still a mess. It made his stomach do a slow and giddy rollover just to look at it. But there was a note from Mason on the table, pegged down with a salt shaker. "Mr. Trenton, Steve Kemp has been picked up in a western Massachusetts town, Twickenham. Your wife and son are not, repeat, are not with him. I did not wake you with this news because Kemp is standing on his right to remain silent. Barring any complication, he will be brought directly to the Scarborough SP barracks for charging on vandalism and possession of illegal drugs. We estimate him here by 11:30 a.m. If anything breaks, I'll call you soonest, Andy Mason."
"Fuck his right to remain silent," Vic growled. He went into the living room, got the number of the Scarborough State Police Barracks, and made the call.
"Mr. Kemp is here," the duty officer told him. "He got here about 15 minutes ago. Mr. Mason is with him now. Kemp's called a lawyer. I don't think Mr. Mason can come to the—"
"You never mind what he can or can't do," Vic said. "You tell him it's Donna Trenton's husband, and I want him to shag his ass over to the phone and talk to me."
A few moments later, Mason came on the line.
"Mr. Trenton, I appreciate your concern, but this brief time before Kemp's lawyer gets here can be very valuable."
"What's he told you?" Mason hesitated and then said,
"He's admitted to the vandalism. I think he finally realized this thing was a lot heavier than a little nose candy stashed in the wheel well of his van. He admitted the vandalism to the Massachusetts officers who brought him over here. But he claims that nobody was home when he did it and that he left undisturbed."
"You don't believe that shit, do you?" Mason said carefully.
"He's quite convincing. I couldn't say that I believe anything right now. If I could just ask him a few more questions."
"Nothing came of Camber's garage?"
"No, I sent Sheriff Bannerman up there with instructions to call in immediately if Mrs. Trenton had been there or if her car was there, and since he didn't call back in—"
"That's hardly definitive, is it?" Vic asked sharply.
"Mr. Trenton, I really must go. If we hear any—"
Vic slammed the telephone down and stood breathing rapidly in the hot silence of the living room. Then he went slowly to the stairs and mounted them. He stood in the upstairs hall for a moment and then went into his son's room. Tad's trucks were lined up neatly against the wall, slant parking style. Looking at them hurt his heart. Tad's yellow slicker was hung on the brass hook by his bed, and his coloring books were piled neatly on his desk. His closet door was open. Vic shut it absently and, barely thinking about what he was doing, put Tad's chair in front of it. He sat on Tad's bed, hands dangling between his legs, and looked out into the hot, bright day.
Dead ends. Nothing but dead ends. And where were they? Dead ends.
Now there was an ominous phrase if ever one had been coined. Dead ends. As a boy Tad's age, he had been fascinated with dead-end roads, his mother had told him once. He wondered if that sort of thing was inherited, if Tad was interested in dead-end roads. He wondered if Tad was still alive. And it suddenly occurred to him that Town Road Number 3, where Joe Camber's garage stood, was a dead-end road. He suddenly looked around and saw that the wall over the head of Tad's bed was bare. The monster words were gone. Now, why had he taken those? Or had Kemp taken them for some weird reason of his own? But if Kemp had been in here, why hadn't he trashed Tad's room as he had those downstairs? Dead ends and monster words. Had she taken the Pinto up to Camber's? He remembered the conversation they'd had about the bulky needle valve only vaguely. She was a little scared of Joe Camber. Hadn't she said that? No. Not Camber. Camber only wanted to mentally undress her. No, it was the dog she was a little scared of. What was his name? They had joked about it. Tad. Tad calling the dog. And again he heard Tad's phantom, ghostly voice, so hopeless and lost in this too empty, suddenly creepy room.
"Cujo,
here, Cujo. Cujo.
And then something happened which Vic never spoke of to anyone in the rest of his life. Instead of hearing Tad's voice in his mind, he was actually hearing it, high and lonely and terrified, a going-away voice that was coming from inside the closet. A cry escaped Vic's throat, and he pushed himself up on Tad's bed, his eyes widening. The closet door was swinging open, pushing the chair in front of it, and his son was crying, "Coo!" And then he realized it wasn't Tad's voice. It was his own tired, overwrought mind making Tad's voice from the thin scraping sound of the chair legs on the painted plank floor. That was all it was, and there were eyes in the closet. He saw eyes, red and sunken and terrible. A little scream escaped his throat. The chair tipped over for no earthly reason, and he saw Tad's teddy bear inside the closet, perched on a stack of sheets and blankets. It was the bear's glass eyes he had seen, no more. Heart thumping heavily in his throat, Vic got up and went to the closet. He could smell something in there, something heavy and unpleasant. Perhaps it was only mothballs. That smell was certainly part of it. But it smelled savage. "Don't be ridiculous. It's just a closet, not a cave, not a monster lair." He looked at Tad's bear. Tad's bear looked back at him, unblinking. Behind the bear, behind the hanging clothes, all was darkness. Anything could be back in there. Anything. But of course nothing was.
"You gave me a scare, bear," he said.
"Monsters stay out of this room," the bear said. Its eyes sparkled. They were dead glass, but they sparkled.
"The door's out of true, that's all," Vic said.
He was sweating. Huge, salty drops ran slowly down his face like tears. "You have no business here," the bear replied.
"What's the matter with me?" Vic asked the bear. "Am I going crazy? Is this what going crazy is like?"
To which Tad's bear replied, "Monsters, leave Tad alone." He closed the closet door and watched, as wide-eyed as a child, as the latch lifted and popped free of its notch. The door began to swing open again.
"I didn't see that. I won't believe I saw that."
He slammed the door and put the chair against it again. Then he took a large stack of Tad's picture books and put them on the chair's seat to weight it down. This time the door stayed closed. Vic stood there looking at the closed door, thinking about dead-end roads. Not much traffic on dead-end roads. All monsters should live under bridges or in closets or at the ends of dead-end roads. It should be like a national law. He was very uneasy now. He left Tad's room, went downstairs, and sat on the back steps. He lit a cigarette with a hand that shook slightly and looked at the gunmetal sky, feeling the sense of unease grow. Something had happened in Tad's room. He wasn't sure what it had been, but it had been something. Yeah, something. Monsters and dogs and closets and garages and dead-end roads. Do we add these up, teacher? Subtract them? Divide? Fractionate? He threw his cigarette away. He did believe it was Kemp, didn't he? Kemp had been responsible for everything. Kemp had wrecked the house. Kemp had damn near wrecked his marriage. Kemp had gone upstairs and shot his semen onto the bed Vic and his wife had slept in for the last 3 years. Kemp had torn a big hole in the mostly comfortable fabric of Vic Trenton's life. Kemp! Kemp! All Steve Kemp's fault! Let's blame the Cold War and the hostage situation in Iran and the depletion of the ozone layer on Kemp.
Stupid. Because not everything was Kemp's fault now, was it? The Zingers business, for instance. Kemp had had nothing to do with that. And Kemp could hardly be blamed for the bad needle valve on Donna's Pinto.
He looked at his old Jag. He was going to go somewhere in it. He couldn't stay here. He would go crazy if he stayed here. He should get in the car and beat it down to Scarborough, grab hold of Kemp and shake him until it came out, until he told what he had done with Donna and Tad. Except by then his lawyer would have arrived, and incredible as it seemed, the lawyer might even have sprung him. Spring. It was a spring that held the needle valve in place. If the spring was bad, the valve could freeze and choke off the flow of gasoline to the carb. Vic went down to the Jag and got in, wincing at the hot leather seat. Get rolling quick. Get some cool in here. Get rolling where? Camber's garage, his mind answered immediately. But that was stupid, wasn't it? Mason had sent Sheriff Bannerman up there with instructions to report immediately if anything was wrong, and the cop hadn't reported back, so that meant that the monster got him. Well, it wouldn't hurt to go up there, would it? And it was something to do. He started the Jag up and headed down the hill toward Route 117, still not entirely sure if he was going to turn left toward I-95 and Scarborough or right toward Town Road Number 3. He paused at the stop sign until someone in back gave him the horn. Then, abruptly, he turned right. It wouldn't hurt to take a quick run up to Joe Camber's. He could be there in 15 minutes. He checked his watch and saw that it was 12:20. The time had come, and Donna knew it. The time might also have gone, but she would have to live with that, and perhaps die with it. No one was going to come. There was going to be no knight on a silver steed riding up Town Road Number 3. Travis McGee was apparently otherwise engaged. Tad was dying. She made herself repeat it aloud in a husky, choked whisper. Tad's dying. She had not been able to create any breeze through the car this morning. Her window would no longer go down, and Tad's window let in nothing but more heat. The one time she had tried to unroll it more than a quarter of the way, Cujo had left his place in the shade of the garage and had come around to Tad's side as fast as he could, growling eagerly. The sweat had now stopped rolling down Tad's face and neck. There was no more sweat left. His skin was dry and hot. His tongue, swelled and dead-looking, protruded over his bottom lip. His breathing had grown so faint that she could barely hear it. Twice she had had to put her head against his chest to make sure that he still breathed at all. Her condition was bad. The car was a blast furnace. The metalwork was now too hot to touch, and so was the plastic wheel. Her leg was a steady, throbbing ache, and she no longer doubted that the dog's bite had infected her with something. Perhaps it was too early for rabies. She prayed to God it was. But the bites were red and inflamed. Cujo was not in much better shape. The big dog seemed to have shrunk inside his matted and blood-streaked coat. His eyes were hazy and nearly vacant, the eyes of an old man stricken with cataracts. Like some old engine of destruction now gradually beating itself to death, but still terribly dangerous, he kept his watch. He was no longer foaming. His muzzle was a dried and lacerated horror. It looked like a gouged chunk of igneous rock that had been coughed out of the hotbed of an old volcano. The old monster, she thought incoherently, keeps his watch still. Had this terrible vigil been only a matter of hours, or had it been her whole life? Surely everything that had gone before had been a dream, little more than a short wait in the wings. The mother who had seemed to be disgusted and repulsed by all those around her, the well-meaning but ineffectual father, the schools, the friends, the dates and dances, they were all a dream to her now, as youth must seem to the old.
Nothing mattered. Nothing was but this silent and sunstruck dooryard where death had been dealt. And yet more death waited in the cards as sure as aces and eights. The old monster kept his watch still, and her son was slipping, slipping, slipping away.
The baseball bat. That was all that remained to her now, the baseball bat, and maybe, if she could get there, something in the dead man's police car, something like a shotgun. She began to shift Tad into the back, grunting and puffing, fighting the waves of dizziness that made her sight gray over. Finally, he was in the hatchback, as silent and still as a sack of grain. She looked out his window, saw the baseball bat lying in the high grass, and opened the door. In the dark mouth of the garage, Cujo stood up and began to advance slowly, head lowered, down the crushed gravel toward her. It was 12:30 when Donna Trenton stepped out of her Pinto for the last time. Vic turned off the Maple Sugar Road and onto Town Road Number 3, just as his wife was going for Brett Camber's old Hillerich and Bradsby in the weeds. He was driving fast, intent on getting up to Camber's so he could turn around and go to Scarborough, some 50 miles away. Perversely, as soon as he had made his decision to come out here first, his mind began dolefully telling him that he was on a wild goose chase. On the whole, he had never felt so impotent in his life. He was moving the Jag along at better than 60, so intent on the road that he was past Gary Pervier's before he realized that Joe Camber's station wagon had been parked there. He slammed on the Jag's brakes, burning 20 feet of rubber. The Jag's nose dipped toward the road. The cop might have gone up to Camber's and found nobody home because Camber was down here. He glanced in the rearview mirror, saw the road was empty, and backed up quickly. He wheeled the Jag into Pervier's driveway and got out. His feelings were remarkably like those of Joe Camber himself, when, 2 days before, Joe had discovered the splatters of blood, only now these were dried and maroon-colored, and the smashed bottom panel of the screen door. A foul metallic taste flooded Vic's mouth. This was all a part of it. Somehow, it was all a part of Tad's and Donna's disappearance. He let himself in, and the smell hit him at once, the bloated green smell of corruption. It had been a hot 2 days. There was something halfway down the hall that looked like a knocked-over end table, except that Vic was mortally sure that it wasn't an end table. Because of the smell. He went down to the thing in the hall. And it wasn't an end table. It was a man. The man appeared to have had his throat cut with an extremely dull blade. Vic stepped back. A dry gagging sound came from his throat. The telephone. He had to call someone about this. He started for the kitchen and then stopped. Suddenly, everything came together in his mind. There was an instant of crushing revelation. It was like two half-pictures coming together to make a three-dimensional whole. The dog. The dog had done this. The Pinto was at Joe Camber's. The Pinto had been there all along. The Pinto and... Oh, my God! Donna! Vic turned and ran for the door and his car. Donna almost went sprawling. That was how bad her legs were. She caught herself and grabbed for the baseball bat, not daring to look around for Cujo until she had it tightly held in her hands, afraid she might lose her balance again. If she had had time to look a little farther, just a little, she would have seen George Bannerman's service pistol lying in the grass. But she did not. She turned unsteadily, and Cujo was running at her. She thrust the heavy end of the baseball bat at the St. Bernard, and her heart sank at the unsteady way the thing wiggled in her hand. The handle was badly splintered then. The St. Bernard shied away, growling. Her breasts rose and fell rapidly in the white cotton bra. The cups were blood-streaked. She had wiped her hands on them after clearing Tad's mouth. They stood staring at each other, measuring each other in the still summer sunlight. The only sounds were her low, rapid breathing, the sound of Cujo growling deep in his chest, and the bright squawk of a sparrow somewhere near. Their shadows were short, shapeless things at their feet. Cujo began to move to his left. Donna moved right. They circled. She held the bat at the point where she believed the split in the wood to be the deepest, her palms tight on the rough texture of the black cat friction tape the handle had been wrapped with. Cujo tensed down.
"Come on, then!"
she screamed at him. And Cujo leaped. She swung the bat like Mickey Mantle going after a high fastball. She missed Cujo's head, but the bat struck him in the ribs. There was a heavy, dull thump and a snapping sound from somewhere inside Cujo. The dog uttered a sound like a scream and went sprawling in the gravel. She felt the bat give sickeningly under the friction tape, but for the moment it still held. Donna cried out in a high, breaking voice and brought the bat down on Cujo's hindquarters. Something else broke. She heard it. The dog bellowed and tried to scramble away, but she was on it again, swinging, pounding, screaming. Her head was high wine and deep iron. The world danced. She was the harpies, the weird sisters. She was all vengeance, not for herself, but for what had been done to her boy. The splintered handle of the bat bulged and pumped like a racing heart beneath her hands and beneath its binding of friction tape. The bat was bloody now. Cujo was still trying to get away, but his movements had slowed. He ducked one blow. The head of the bat skittered through the gravel. But the next one struck him midway on his back, driving him to his rear legs. She thought he was done. She even backed off a step or two, her breath screaming in and out of her lungs like some hot liquid. Then he uttered a deep snarl of rage and leaped at her again. She swung the bat and heard that heavy whacking thud again. But as Cujo went rolling in the gravel, the old bat finally split in two. The fat part flew away and struck the right front hubcap of the Pinto with a musical bung. She was left with a splintered 18-inch wand in her hand. Cujo was getting to his feet again, dragging himself to his feet. Blood poured down his sides. His eyes flickered like lights on a defective pinball machine. And still it seemed to her that he was grinning.
"Come on, then!" she shrieked.
For the last time, the dying ruin that had been Brett Camber's good dog Cujo leaped at the woman that had caused all his misery. Donna lunged forward with the remains of the baseball bat, and a long, sharp hickory splinter plunged deep into Cujo's right eye, and then into his brain. There was a small and unimportant popping sound, the sound a grape might make when squeezed suddenly between the fingers. Cujo's forward motion carried him into her and knocked her sprawling. His teeth now snapped and snarled bare inches from her neck. She put her arm up as Cujo crawled farther on top of her. His eye was now oozing down the side of his face. His breath was hideous. She tried to push his muzzle up and his jaws clamped on her forearm.
"Stop!" she screamed. "Oh, stop! Won't you ever stop? Please, please, please!"
Blood was flowing down onto her face in a sticky drizzle. Her blood, the dog's blood. The pain in her arm was a sheeting flare that seemed to fill the whole world. And little by little he was forcing it down. The splintered handle of the bat wavered and jiggled grotesquely, seeming to grow from his head where his eye had been. He went for her neck. Donna felt his teeth there, and with a final wavering cry, she pistoned her arms out and pushed him aside. Cujo thudded heavily to the ground. His rear leg scratched at the gravel. They slowed, slowed, stopped. His remaining eye glared up at the hot summer sky. His tail lay across her shins, as heavy as a Turkish rug runner. He pulled in a breath and let it out. He took another. He made a thick snorting sound, and suddenly a rill of blood ran from his mouth. Then he died.
Donna Trenton howled her triumph. She got halfway to her feet, fell down, and managed to get up again. She took two shuffling steps and stumbled over the dog's body, scoring her knees with scrapes. She crawled to where the heavy end of the baseball bat lay, its far end streaked with gore. She picked it up and gained her feet again by holding onto the hood of the Pinto. She tottered back to where Cujo lay. She began to pound him with the baseball bat. Each downward swing ended with a heavy meat thud. Black strips of friction tape danced and flew in the hot air. Splinters gouged into the soft pads of her palms, and blood ran down her wrists and forearms. She was still screaming, but her voice had broken with that first howl of triumph, and all that came out now was a series of growling croaks. She sounded as Cujo himself had near the end. The bat rose and fell. She bludgeoned the dead dog. Behind her, Vic's Jag turned into the Cambers' driveway. He didn't know what he had expected, but it hadn't been this. He had been afraid, but the sight of his wife, could that really be Donna? Standing over the twisted and smashed thing in the driveway, striking it again and again with something that looked like a caveman's club. That turned his fear to a bright silvery panic that almost precluded thought. For one infinite moment, which he would never admit to himself later, he felt an impulse to throw the Jag in reverse and drive away, to drive forever. What was going on in this still and sunny dooryard was monstrous. Instead, he turned off the engine and leaped out. Donna? Donna? She appeared not to hear him or even realize that he was there. Her cheeks and forehead were savagely welted with sunburn, the left leg of her slacks were shredded and soaked with blood, and her belly looked gored. The baseball bat rose and fell. She made harsh cawing sounds. Blood flew up from the dog's limp carcass. Donna! He got hold of the baseball bat on the backswing and wrenched it out of her hands. He threw it away and grabbed her naked shoulder. She turned to face him, her eyes blank and hazed, her hair straggling, witch-like anyway. She stared at him, shook her head, and stepped away. Donna, honey, my Jesus, he said softly. It was Vic, but Vic couldn't be here. It was a mirage. It was the dog's sickening disease at work in her, making her hallucinate. She stepped away, rubbed her eyes, and he was still there. She stretched out one trembling hand, and the mirage folded strong brown hands over it. That was good. Her hands hurt dreadfully. She croaked in a whisper. Vic. Yes, honey. It's me. Where's Tad? The mirage was real. It was really him. She wanted to cry, but no tears came. Her eyes only moved in their sockets like overheated ball bearings. Vic. Vic. He put an arm around her. Where's Tad, Donna? Car. Sick. Hospital.
She could now barely whisper, and even that was failing her. Soon she would be able to do no more than mouth words. But it didn't matter, did it?
Vic was here. She and Tad were saved.
He left her and went to the car. She stood where he had left her, looking fixedly down at the dog's battered body. At the end, it hadn't been so bad, had it? When there was nothing left but survival, when you were right down to the strings and nap and ticking of yourself, you survived or you died, and that seemed perfectly all right. The blood didn't seem so bad now, nor the brains that were leaking out of Cujo's cloven head. Nothing seemed so bad now. Vic was here, and they were saved.
Oh, my God,
Vic said, his voice rising thinly in the stillness. She looked over and saw him taking something out of the back of her Pinto, a sack of something. Potatoes? Oranges? What? Had she been shopping before all this happened?
Yes, but she had taken the groceries into the house. She and Tad had taken them in. They used his wagon. So what?
Tad, she tried to say, and ran to him. Vic carried Tad into the thin shade at the side of the house and laid him down. Tad's face was very white. His hair lay like straw on his fragile skull. His hands lay on the grass, seemingly without enough weight to crush the stems beneath their backs. Vic put his head on Tad's chest. He looked up at Donna. His face was white, but calm enough.
How long has he been dead, Donna?
Dead? She tried to scream at him. Her mouth moved like the mouth of a figure on a TV set, the volume control of which has been turned all the way down.
He's not dead. He wasn't dead when I put him in the hatchback. What are you telling me?
He's dead.
What are you telling me, you bastard?
She tried to say those things in her voiceless voice. Had Tad's life slid away at the same time the dog's life had slid away? It was impossible. No god, no fate could be so monstrously cruel. She ran at her husband and shoved him. Vic, expecting anything but that, fell over on his butt. She crouched over Tad. She put his hands above his head. She opened his mouth, pinched his nostrils shut, and breathed her voiceless breath into her son's lungs. In the driveway, the somnolent summer flies had found the corpse of Cujo and that of Sheriff George Bannerman, husband to Victoria, father to Katrina. They had no preference between the dog and the man. They were democratic flies. The sun blared triumphantly down. It was 1:50 now, and the fields shimmered and danced with silent summer. The sky was faded blue denim. Aunt Evie's prediction had come true. She breathed for her son. She breathed, she breathed. Her son was not dead. She had not gone through this hell for her son to be dead. And it simply would not be. It would not be. She breathed, she breathed. She breathed for her son. She was still doing it when the ambulance pulled into the driveway 20 minutes later. She would not let Vic near the boy. When he came near, she bared her teeth and growled soundlessly at him. Stunned with grief nearly to the point of distraction, deeply sure at the final bedrock level of his consciousness that none of this could be happening, he broke into Camber's house by way of the porch door at which Donna had stared so long and hard. The inner door beyond it had not been locked. He used the telephone. When he came outside again, Donna was still administering mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to their dead son. He started toward her and then swerved away. He went to the Pinto instead and opened the hatchback again. Heat roared out at him like an invisible lion. Had they existed in there Monday afternoon and all day Tuesday and until noon of today?
It was impossible to believe they had. Underneath the hatchback's floor, where the spare tire was, he found an old blanket. He shook it out and put it over Bannerman's mutilated body. He sat down on the grass then and stared out at Town Road Number 3 and the dusty pines beyond. His mind floated serenely away. The ambulance driver and the two orderlies loaded Bannerman's body into the Castle Rock rescue unit. They approached Donna. Donna bared her teeth at them. Her parched lips formed the words, "He's alive, alive." When one of the orderlies tried to pull her gently to her feet and lead her away, she bit him. Later, this orderly would need to go to the hospital himself for anti-rabies treatment. The other orderly came to help. She fought them. They stood away warily. Vic still sat on the lawn, his chin propped in his hands, looking across the road. The rescue unit driver brought a syringe. There was a struggle. The syringe was broken. Tad lay on the grass, still dead. His patch of shade was a little bigger now. Two more police cars arrived. Roscoe Fisher was in one of them. When the ambulance driver told him that George Bannerman was dead, Roscoe began to cry. The other policeman advanced on Donna. There was another struggle, short and furious, and Donna Trenton was finally pulled away from her son by four sweating, straining men. She nearly broke free again, and Roscoe Fisher, still crying, joined them. She screamed soundlessly, whipping her head from side to side. Another syringe was produced, and she was injected successfully this time. A stretcher came down from the ambulance, and the orderlies wheeled it over to where Tad lay on the grass. Tad, still dead, was put on it. A sheet was pulled up over his head. At the sight of this, Donna redoubled her struggles. She freed one hand and began to flail about wildly with it. Then suddenly she was free. "Donna," Vic said. He got to his feet. "Honey, it's over. Honey, please. Let go. Let go." She did not go for the stretcher that her son lay on. She went for the baseball bat. She picked it up and began to bludgeon the dog again. The flies rose in a shiny green-black cloud. The sound of the ball bat making contact was heavy and terrible, a butcher shop sound. Cujo's body jumped a little each time she struck it. The cops began to move forward. "No," one of the orderlies said quietly. And a few moments later, Donna simply collapsed. Brett Camber's bat rolled away from her relaxing hand. The ambulance left 5 minutes or so later, siren howling. Vic had been offered a shot to calm your nerves, Mr. Trenton. And although he felt utterly tranquilized already, he had accepted the shot to be polite. He picked up the cellophane the orderly had stripped from the surette and examined the word Upjohn printed on it carefully. "We ran an advertising campaign for these guys once," he told the orderly. "That so?" the orderly asked cautiously. He was a fairly young man, and he felt that he might throw up sometime soon. He had never seen such a mess in his life. One of the police cars was standing by to take Vic to Northern Cumberland Hospital in Bridgeton. "Can you wait a minute?" he asked. The two cops nodded. They were also staring at Vic Trenton in a very cautious way, as if whatever he had might be catching. He opened both doors of the Pinto. He had to tug long and hard at Donna's. The dog had dented it in a way he wouldn't have believed. Her purse was in there, her shirt. The shirt had a jagged tear in it, as if maybe the dog had taken a chomp out of it. There were some empty Slim Jim wrappers on the dashboard and Tad's thermos bottle smelling of sour milk. Tad's Snoopy lunchbox. His heart gave a heavy, horrid wrench at the sight of that, and he wouldn't allow himself to think of what that meant in terms of the future. If there was any future after this terrible hot day. He found one of Tad's sneakers. Tatter, he thought. Oh, Tatter.
The strength went out of his legs, and he sat down heavily on the passenger seat, looking between his legs at the strip of chrome at the bottom of the door frame.
Why? Why had something like this been allowed to happen? How could so many events have conspired together?
His head was suddenly throbbing violently, his nose closed with tears, and his sinuses began to pound. He snorted the tears back and passed a hand over his face. It occurred to him that, counting Tad, Cujo had been responsible for the deaths of at least 3 people, more than that if the Cambers were discovered to be among his victims. Did the cop he had covered with the blanket have a wife and children? Probably.
If I'd gotten here even an hour earlier, if I hadn't gone to sleep,
his mind cried.
I was so sure it was Kemp, so sure. If I'd gotten here just 15 minutes earlier, would that have been enough? If I hadn't talked to Roger so long, would Tad be alive now?
When did he die?
Did it really happen at all? And how am I supposed to deal with it for the rest of my life without going mad? What's going to happen to Donna?
Another police car pulled up. One of the cops got out of it and conferred with one of the cops waiting for Vic. The latter stepped forward and said quietly,
I think we ought to go, Mr. Trenton. Quentin here says there are reporters on the way. You don't want to talk to any reporters just now.
No, Vic agreed and started to get up. As he did, he saw a bit of yellow at the very bottom of his field of vision, a bit of paper poking out from under Tad's seat. He pulled it out and saw it was the monster words he had written to ease Tad's mind at bedtime. The sheet was crumpled and ripped in 2 places and badly stained with sweat. Along the deep creases it was nearly transparent.
Monsters stay out of this room. You have no business here. No monsters under Tad's bed. You can't fit under there. No monsters hiding in Tad's closet. It's too small in there. No monsters outside of Tad's window. You can't hold on out there. No vampires, no werewolves, no things that bite. You have no business here. Nothing will touch Tad or hurt Tad all this night.
He could read no more. He crumpled the sheet of paper up and threw it at the dead dog's body. The paper was a sentimental lie, its sentiments as inconstant as the color in that stupid runny-dyed cereal. It was all a lie. The world was full of monsters, and they were all allowed to bite the innocent and the unwary. He let himself be led to the police car. They drove him away, as George Bannerman and Tad Trenton and Donna Trenton had been driven away before him. After a while, a veterinarian came in a panel truck. She looked at the dead dog, then donned long rubber gloves and brought out a circular bone saw. The cops, realizing what she was going to do, turned away. The vet cut off the St. Bernard's head and put it in a large white plastic garbage bag. Later that day, it was forwarded to the State Commissioner of Animals, where the brain would be tested for rabies.
So Cujo was gone, too.
It was 4:15 that afternoon when Holly called Charity to the telephone. Holly looked mildly worried.
It sounds like somebody official, she said.
About an hour earlier, Brett had given in to Jim Jr.'s endless supplications and had accompanied his young cousin down to the playground at the Stratford Community Center. Since then, the house had been silent except for the women's voices as they talked over old times. The good old times, Charity amended silently. The time Daddy had fallen off the hay truck and gone into a great big cow flop in back field.
but no mention of the times he had beaten them until they couldn't sit down, in payment for some real or imagined transgression. The time they had snuck into the old Met Theater in Lisbon Falls to see Elvis in Love Me Tender, but not the time Mama had had her credit cut off at the Red and White and had backed out of the grocery in tears, leaving a full basket of provisions behind and everybody watching. How Red Timmons from up the road was always trying to kiss Holly on their way back from school. But not how Red had lost an arm when his tractor turned turtle on him in August of 1962. The two of them had discovered it was all right to open the closets, as long as you didn't poke too far back in them, because things might still be lurking there, ready to bite. Twice Charity had opened her mouth to tell Holly that she and Brett would be going home tomorrow, and both times she had closed it again, trying to think of a way she could say it without leading Holly to believe they didn't like it here. Now the problem was momentarily forgotten as she sat at the telephone table, a fresh cup of tea beside her. She felt a little anxious. Nobody likes to get a telephone call while they're on vacation from someone who sounds official. "Hello?" she said. Holly watched her sister's face go white, listened as her sister said, "What? What? No. No, there must be some mistake. I tell you, there must..." She fell silent, listening to the telephone. Some dreadful news was being passed down the wire from Maine, Holly thought. She could see it in the gradually tightening mask of her sister's face, although she could hear nothing from the phone itself except a series of meaningless squawks. Bad news from Maine. To her, it was an old story. It was all right for her and Charity to sit in the sunny morning kitchen drinking tea and eating orange sections and talking about sneaking into the Met Theater. It was all right, but it didn't change the fact that every day she could remember of her childhood had brought a little piece of bad news with it, each piece a part of her early life's jigsaw, the whole picture so terrible that she would not really have minded it if she had never seen her older sister again. Torn cotton underpants that the other girls at school made fun of, picking potatoes until her back ached, and if you stood up, suddenly the blood rushed out of your head so fast you felt like you were going to faint. Red Timmons, how carefully she and Charity had avoided mentioning Red's arm. So badly crushed it had to be amputated. But when Holly heard, she had been glad, so glad, because she remembered Red throwing a green apple at her one day, hitting her in the face, making her nose bleed, making her cry. She remembered Red giving her Indian rubs and laughing. She remembered an occasional nourishing dinner of Shed's peanut butter and Cheerios when things were particularly bad. She remembered the way the outhouse stank in high summer. That smell was shit. And in case you should wonder, that wasn't a good smell. Bad news from Maine. And somehow, for some crazed reason, she knew they would never discuss, even if they both lived to be 100 and spent the last 20 old maid years together. Charity had elected to stick with that life. Her looks were almost entirely gone. There were wrinkles around her eyes. Her breasts sagged, even in her bra they sagged. There were only 6 years between them, but an observer might well have thought it was more like 16. And worst of all, she seemed totally unconcerned about dooming her lovely, intelligent boy to a similar life, unless he got smart, unless he wised up. For the tourists, Holly thought with an angry bitterness that all the good years had not changed, it was vacation land. But if you came from the Puckies, it was day after day of bad news. Then one day you looked in the mirror and the face looking back at you was Charity Camber's face. And now there was more dreadful news from Maine, that home of all dreadful news. Charity was hanging up the telephone. She sat staring at it, her hot tea steaming beside her.
Joe's dead, she announced suddenly.
Holly sucked in breath. Her teeth felt cold.
Why did you come? She felt like shrieking. I knew you'd bring it all with you, and sure enough, you did.
Oh, honey, she said, are you sure?
That was a man from Augusta, name of Mason, from the Attorney General's office, Law Enforcement Division.
Was it a car accident?
Charity looked directly at her then, and Holly was both shocked and terrified to see that her sister did not look like someone who had just received dreadful news. She looked like someone who had just received good news. The lines in her face had smoothed out. Her eyes were blank. But was it shock behind that blankness, or the dreamy awakening of possibility? If she had seen Charity Camber's face when she had checked the numbers on her winning lottery ticket, she might have known.
Charity?
It was the dog, Charity said. It was Cujo.
The dog?
At first, she was bewildered, unable to see any possible connection between the death of Charity's husband and the Camber family dog. Then she realized. The implications came in terms of Red Timmons' horribly mangled left arm, and she said in a higher, shriller tone, "The dog?" Before Charity could reply, if she had means to, there were cheery voices in the backyard, Jim Jr.'s high piping one, and then Brett's lower and amused, answering. And now Charity's face changed. It became stricken. It was a face that Holly remembered and hated well, an expression that made all faces the same, an expression she had felt often enough on her own face in those old days.
The boy, Charity said. Brett. Holly.
How am I going to tell Brett his father is dead? Holly had no answer for her. She could only stare helplessly at her sister and wish neither of them had come. Rabid dog kills four in bizarre three-day reign of terror, the headline on that evening's edition of the Portland Evening Express blared. The subhead read, Lone Survivor at Northern Cumberland Hospital in Guarded Condition. The headline on the following day's Press Herald read, Father tells of wife's doomed struggle to save son. That evening, the story had been relegated to the bottom of page one. Mrs. Trenton responding to rabies treatment, doctor says. And in a sidebar, dog had no shots, local vet. 3 days after it had ended, the story was inside on page four. State Health Agency blames rabid fox or raccoon for dog's Castle Rock rampage. A final story that week carried the news that Victor Trenton had no intention of suing the surviving members of the Camber family, who were said to be in deep shock. This intelligence was scant, but provided a pretext upon which the entire tale could be rehashed. A week later, the front page of the Sunday paper carried a feature story on what had happened. A week after that, a national tabloid offered a fervid synopsis of what had happened, headed, Tragic Battle in Maine as Mom Battles Killer St. Bernard. And that was really the end of the coverage. There was a rabies scare in central Maine that fall. An expert attributed it to rumor and the horrifying but isolated incident in Castle Rock. Donna Trenton was in the hospital for nearly 4 weeks. She finished her cycle of treatments for the rabid dog bites with a good deal of pain, but no serious problems. But because of the potential seriousness of the disease and because of her deep mental depression, she was closely watched. In late August, Vic drove her home. They spent a quiet, showery day around the house.
That evening, as they sat in front of the television, not really watching it, Donna asked him about AdWorks.
"Everything's fine there," he said. "Roger got the last serial professor commercial on the rails single-handed, with Rob Martin's help, of course. Now we're involved in a major new campaign for the whole Sharp line."
Half a lie. Roger was involved. Vic went in 3, sometimes 4 days a week and either pushed his pencil around or looked at his typewriter.
"But the Sharp people are being very careful to make sure that none of what we're doing will go beyond the 2-year period we signed for. Roger was right. They're going to dump us. But by then it won't matter if they do."
"Good," she said. She had bright periods now, periods when she seemed very much like her old self, but she was still listless most of the time. She had lost 20 pounds and looked scrawny. Her complexion was not very good. Her nails were ragged. She looked at the TV for a while and then turned to him. She was crying.
"Donna," he said. "Oh, babe."
He put his arms around her and held her. She was soft but unyielding in his arms. Through the softness, he could feel the angles of her bones in too many places.
"Can we live here?"
she managed in an unsteady voice.
"Vic, can we live here?"
"I don't know," he said. "I think we ought to give it a damned good shot."
"Maybe. I should ask if you can go on living with me. If you said no, I'd understand. I'd understand perfectly."
"I don't want anything else but to live with you. I knew that all along, I think. Maybe there was an hour right after I got Kemp's note when I didn't know, but that was the only time. Donna, I love you. I always have."
Now she put her arms around him and hugged him tight. Soft summer rain struck the windows and made gray and black shadowy patterns on the floor.
"I couldn't save him," she said. "That's what keeps coming back on me. I can't get rid of it. I go over it again and again and again. If I'd run for the porch sooner or gotten the baseball bat."
She swallowed.
"And when I finally did get up the guts to go out there, it was just over. He was dead."
He could have reminded her that she'd had Tad's welfare in mind above her own the whole time. That the reason she hadn't gone for the door was because of what would have happened to Tad if the dog had gotten to her before she could get inside. He could have told her that the siege had probably weakened the dog as much as it had Donna herself, and if she had tried Cujo with the baseball bat earlier on, the outcome might have been entirely different. As it was, the dog had almost killed her in the end. But he understood that these points had been brought to her attention again and again by himself and by others, and that not all the logic in the world could blunt the pain of coming upon that mute pile of coloring books, or seeing the swing empty and motionless at the bottom of its arc in the backyard. Logic could not blunt her terrible sense of personal failure. Only time could do those things. And time would do an imperfect job. He said,
"I couldn't save him either."
"You?"
"I was so sure it was Kemp. If I'd gone up there earlier, if I hadn't fallen asleep, even if I hadn't talked to Roger on the phone."
"No," she said gently. "Don't."
"I have to. I guess you do, too. We'll just have to get along. That's what people do, you know. They just get along and try to help each other.
I keep feeling him, sensing him around every corner.
Yeah, me too.
He and Roger had taken all of Tad's toys to the Salvation Army 2 Saturdays ago. When it was done, they had come back here and had a few beers in front of the ball game, not talking much. And when Roger went home, Vic went upstairs and sat on the bed in Tad's room and wept until it seemed the weeping would pull all his insides apart. He wept and wanted to die. But he hadn't died, and the next day he had gone back to work.
"Make us some coffee," he said, and slapped her lightly on the rump. "I'll light a fire. Chilly in here."
"All right."
She got up.
"Vic?"
"What?"
Her throat worked.
"I love you too."
"Thanks," he said. "I think I needed that."
She smiled wanly and went to make the coffee, and they got through the evening, although Tad was still dead. They got through the next day as well, and the next. It was not much better at the end of August, nor in September, but by the time the leaves had turned and begun to fall, it was a little better. A little. She was wired with tension and trying not to show it. When Brett came back from the barn, knocked the snow from his boots, and let himself in the kitchen door, she was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a cup of tea. For a moment, he only looked at her. He had lost some weight and had grown taller in the last 6 months. The total effect was to make him look gangling, where he had always before seemed compact and yet lithe. His grades during the first quarter hadn't been so good, and he had been in trouble twice, scuffles in the schoolyard both times, probably over what had happened this last summer. But his second quarter marks had been a lot better.
"Mom?
Mama?
Is it?"
"Alva brought him over," she said. She set the teacup on the saucer carefully, and it did not chatter.
"No law says you have to keep him."
"Has he had his shots?" Brett asked, and her heart broke a little that should be his first question.
"As a matter of fact, he has," she said.
"Alva tried to slip that over on me, but I made him show me the vet's bill. $9 it was. Distemper and rabies. Also, there's a tube of cream for ticks and ear mites. If you don't want him, Alva will give me my $9 back." Money had become important to them. For a little bit, she hadn't been sure if they would be able to keep the place, or even if they should try to keep it. She had talked it over with Brett, being level with him. There had been a small life insurance policy. Mr. Schuper at the Casco Bank in Bridgeton had explained to her that if the money was put in a special trust account, it, plus the lottery money, would make nearly all of the outstanding mortgage payments over the next 5 years. She had landed a decent job in the packing and billing department of Castle Rock's one real industry, Trace Optical. The sale of Joe's equipment, including the new chainfall, had brought in an additional $3,000. It was possible for them to keep the place, she had explained to Brett, but it was apt to be a hard scrabble. The alternative was an apartment in town. Brett had slept on it, and it had turned out that what he wanted was what she wanted, to keep the home place, and so they had stayed.
"What's his name?" Brett asked.
"Doesn't have a name. He's just weaned."
"Is he a breed?"
"Yes," she said, and then laughed. "He's a Heinz. 57 varieties. He smiled back, and the smile was strained, but Charity reckoned it better than no smile at all.
"Could he come in? It started to snow again."
"He can come in if you put down papers, and if he piddles around, you clean it up."
"All right.
He opened the door to go out.
What do you want to call him, Brett?
I don't know, Brett said. There was a long, long pause. I don't know yet. I'll have to think on it.
She had an impression that he was crying and restrained an impulse to go to him. Besides, his back was to her and she couldn't really tell.
He was getting to be a big boy, and as much as it pained her to know it, she understood that big boys often don't want their mothers to know they're crying.
He went outside and brought the dog back in, carrying it cradled in his arms. It remained unnamed until the following spring, when for no reason either of them could exactly pinpoint, they began to call it Willie. It was a small, lively, short-haired dog, mostly terrier. Somehow, it just looked like a Willie. The name stuck. Much later that spring, Charity got a small pay raise. She began to put away $10 a week toward Brett's college. Shortly following those mortal events in the Camber dooryard, Cujo's remains were cremated. The ashes went out with the trash and were disposed of at the Augusta Waste Treatment Plant. It would perhaps not be amiss to point out that he had always tried to be a good dog. He had tried to do all the things his man and his woman, and most of all his boy, had asked or expected of him. He would have died for them if that had been required. He had never wanted to kill anybody. He had been struck by something, possibly destiny or fate, or only a degenerative nerve disease called rabies. Free will was not a factor. The small cave into which Cujo had chased the rabbit was never discovered. Eventually, for whatever vague reasons small creatures may have, the bats moved on. The rabbit was unable to get out, and it starved to death in slow, soundless misery. Its bones, so far as I know, still remain there, with the bones of those small animals unlucky enough to have tumbled into that place before it. This is Lorna Raver. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Cujo by Stephen King. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Josh Stanton. Cujo is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Blackstone Audio, Inc. Copyright 2010. All rights reserved.